5. Let's jump right in. Here's what the jury soon heard about Erin Patterson. She was born Erin Trudy Scudder on 30th of September 1974. No other facts about her childhood were led, other than her claim that her mother used to weigh her quite regularly. I still have no idea where Erin went to school, nor was there any mention of her school friends. We did hear she attended Monash University, and she graduated with a degree in either business or accounting. Simon wasn't sure which of those it was, and Erin didn't say. Sometime after she graduated from university, presumably in the mid to late 1990s, she took a course in air traffic control and became a qualified air traffic controller and worked as one in Victoria, Simon said at Tullamarine, for 1 to 2 years. Those who want to unearth more details about Erin's time as an air traffic controller will probably find them if they go hunting, but no more details were presented as evidence in this trial. And I couldn't go hunting. That was not allowed. And I was being a good girl. We were also never told what sort of strengths and characteristics were needed to become a qualified air traffic controller. Common sense would suggest there are a few requirements. An air traffic controller is responsible for the safe takeoff and landing of thousands of lives in every shift, so you can fill in here what capacities you think she might have had. Erin and Simon Patterson met when they were both working in the Monash City Council offices in Glen Waverley, a southeastern suburb of Melbourne, after her stint in air traffic control. In fact, Simon could only remember the time frame as the early 2000s. Erin first thought it would have been 2003, then corrected it to 2004. Erin was working for the RSPCA, who were contracted to deliver animal management services to Monash City Council. As such, they supplied the council with two rangers and an admin officer. Erin was the admin officer. Simon, meanwhile, was a civil engineer. Actually, Erin thought he was a traffic engineer, but Simon called himself a civil engineer, which does sound better. What did a civil engineer at Monash City Council do? Well, that was never asked. So, fix potholes? Create bypasses? You tell me. I suppose it doesn't matter. Anyway, that's where Erin Scudder met Simon Patterson. But it hardly seemed to be love at first sight. We didn't hear about any heart-stopping, the moment I first saw you scenario. I guess there was a fairly eclectic group of friends that formed throughout that organisation, remembered Simon. And Erin and I were both part of it, and then slowly we got to know each other. Erin didn't disagree. We had mutual friends, is how I remember it coming together. He was friends with people that I had become friends with, so we would come up against each other at lunch or after work drinks, that sort of thing. Call me harsh, but it wasn't sounding like a romance made in heaven. Then again, that shouldn't be a pejorative statement. That's the way life happens for a lot of couples. Love that evolves at its own pace is just as valid and rewarding as love that hits both partners like a steam train. I've known both. Calm down. For several weeks in early 2005, Erin claimed they had a lot of conversations about life, politics, and a lot about religion. Many of those conversations happened on weekends when Simon would want to go camping with a different group of friends, not the Monash City Council gang. This was another group. Erin was often also invited, or maybe she asked to tag along and Simon was happy to have her. It was unclear how Erin made the transition across to this other group. Simon found her highly intelligent and very witty. She was fun company. They were the only clues we were given. One of these camping weekends, around Easter 2005, took place down in Corumburra, a lovely little country town southeast of Melbourne, about an hour and a half away. That's where Erin first met Simon's parents, Don and Gail. And it was also the first time she met Simon's aunt and uncle, Heather and Ian Wilkinson. Ian had been the pastor at Corumburra Baptist Church since 1999, and all the Pattersons were committed churchgoers. At the time, Aaron was a self-proclaimed fundamentalist atheist, while Simon, like his parents, was a Christian. I was trying to convert him to being an atheist, but things happened in reverse and I became a Christian, she recalled. Colin Mandy asked whether she remembered the experience of going to church during that Easter of 2005. Yeah, I do, Erin replied. I remember being really excited about it because I'd never been to a church service before. I had been to my sister's wedding in a church, but that was it, and I was really looking forward to it. It was at the Corumburra Baptist Church, and I remember there was a banner up on the wall behind where Ian was preaching. He was giving a sermon that day, and there was a banner. It could still be there now. It has on it faith, hope, and love. And Ian gave a sermon about that. There's a passage in the Bible that talks about faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. And I remember Ian giving a sermon on that. And then we had communion, which I was welcome to participate in. And what impact did that church service have on you? Prompted Mandy. I had what at best can be described as like a spiritual experience. I'd been approaching religion as an intellectual exercise until that point. Does that make sense? Good question. But I had what I would call a religious experience there, and it quite overwhelmed me. You had to hear the way Erin said this to understand the doubts I had about it. It was almost like she was reciting what she'd read somewhere about what it should feel like. Much later, comments Erin posted on Facebook would also indicate that this conversion might not have been completely sincere, which was not helped by the reputation, well-founded in many instances, she had by then gained for compulsive lying. But when it comes to one person relating a private feeling, who knows? Maybe it was true. What can be said, however, is that she recalled more details about her conversion to Christianity than about her falling in love with Simon, not to mention her complete lack of detail regarding which Asian grocer she said she had bought dried mushrooms from in 2023. According to Erin, she and Simon were friends for several months before they started dating. Through the first half of 2005, they often camped over weekends. They spent many hours talking at that time and became a lot closer. Simon had become very work-focused, but he wanted to make sure that he could also turn off from work. That was his reason for camping. The church was the other pillar in his life. Erin started accompanying Simon to his suburban church in Melbourne, and by July 2005, they were romantically involved. By late 2005 or early 2006, they had started attending Bible study together, along with Simon's cousin, David. During this period, Erin said, she saw Don and Gail many times and would often be invited over for a meal, almost monthly. Don and Gail were living in Range Court, Corumburra, at the time. Simon was living in an apartment owned by his parents in Oakley East, and Erin was living in a little hamlet town called Almerta, about a 20-minute drive from Corumburra. At some point in 2006, Erin's grandmother died, and Erin was one of several beneficiaries from her large estate. The estate consisted of several commercial properties that needed to be sold in an orderly fashion. From the beginning, Erin was told it would take some time to settle the estate, and the distributions from it would happen in stages. Nonetheless, on reasonable estimates, the total figure Erin was likely to inherit over time was widely accepted to be in the vicinity of $2 million. The first instalment of this inheritance was received by Erin in February 2007. Also in February 2007, Simon and Erin announced their engagement. Were these two events linked in any way, or were they pure coincidence? The question was never asked, so we don't know. Let's be generous and assume not. Simon gave only a brief account of the courtship that led to their nuptials. tacked onto the end of his sentence describing how they met. He said, "Then slowly we got to know each other, and then I guess we started a romantic relationship and then got married." "Yep, I guess you did." The first people who knew of their engagement were Simon's parents, Don and Gail. Erin and Simon were married on the 2nd of June 2007 in the Anglican Church in Corranborough. And Erin was walked down the aisle by Ian and Heather Wilkinson's son, David, who only got one other specific mention in the whole trial. Erin's own parents were on a train in Russia, taking a holiday. Okay, let's just stop there for a second. On a train in Russia? I beg you, what? Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm not normal. But if my mother had said, "I'm sorry, darling, I know it's your wedding, but if you can't move the date, I don't think your father and me will be able to make it," I would have been, to be understated, a little salty. Given we were instructed to listen to the evidence logically and dispassionately, I'll just leave it at that. But WTF? Sorry, throw the tap mixer to cold. No emotion. When giving this evidence, Erin didn't sound upset. She didn't make it sound unusual. It didn't worry her. Nothing to see here. Mum and Dad were just in Russia while she was exchanging vows with Simon and being accepted into the whole Patterson family. A church wedding in Corranborough in front of all of Simon's relatives, with the reception held in a huge marquee on the vacant block of land Don and Gail owned, right next to their house in Range Court. The whole thing was beautiful. A magical day. Colin Mandy drew this response late in the trial when questioning the defence's only witness, Erin herself. He seemed happy that it added another brick to the edifice he was carefully building. That edifice was meant to be a shrine to the great relationship Erin enjoyed with Don and Gail, a relationship that had been one of affection and inclusivity from the very beginning. It was inconceivable she would ever want to kill them. However, I could sense I wasn't the only juror who was wondering if there wasn't more going on here. But we could wonder all we liked. There were no further questions about this, and none of the other witnesses supplied any further contextual details. The evidence just stopped there. With just the bland fact, her parents weren't at her wedding. So what? Make of it what you will. All I could do was mark it with an asterisk and keep listening. Simon and Erin took a brief long weekend in Olinda in the Dandenong Ranges for a honeymoon. Then she moved into his apartment in North Road, Oakley East, the one owned by Don and Gail. By this time, neither of them worked at Monash City Council, although where they were working is a mystery. We were never told. It wasn't clear whether Erin was working at anything. The only evidence we heard was that, before the wedding, they had agreed to buy a Nissan Patrol four-wheel drive and, on returning from their honeymoon, Simon sought leave from his work, whatever that was. Then they just packed up and hit the road. They were going to explore Australia and the world and camp in tents wherever they went. You're in your early 30s, you've inherited a fortune. Fuck it, let's go. And that's exactly what they did. By September, they had meandered through Birdsville, Oodnadatta, and a bunch of other bush towns, and they'd ended up in Perth. From there, they flew to Africa for a couple of months. They spent some time in Botswana with some of Simon's relatives. We were never told who they were. And sometime in Zimbabwe, visiting one of Simon's friends. Sorry, again, no idea. They completed their African safari by camping through Namibia. Then they returned to Perth at the end of 07. Simon wanted to stay on the move, but after 6 months of living in tents and out of suitcases, Erin had other ideas. "I was pretty keen to stop for a while and put down roots," she said. "I was keen to start having babies, I guess, for want of a better way to phrase it." I was with Erin on that one. That's how most people phrase it. Nothing unusual in that situation. Simon got a job with an inner city local council in Perth. Erin applied to do something at uni. Details were not supplied, but perhaps it was vet science. or it could have been straight science or a law course. We heard she enrolled in all of those at various unidentified points in time. Anyway, by April 08, she was pregnant with their son, and he was born on the 14th of January 2009. For legal and ethical reasons, the son's real name is not allowed to be published, so we'll call him Jack. In Simon's evidence, their son's birth was merely another dot point in his summary of their life together. But Aaron's recollection painted a different picture. His birth was very traumatic, she told us. It went on for a very long time, and they tried to get him out with forceps, and he wouldn't come out. And he started to go into distress, and they lost his heartbeat. So they did an emergency caesarean and got him out quickly. I had to stay in hospital for a few days, probably a week, and Jack was in the neonatal ICU for a while. When it got to the point where he was off oxygen and off the feeding tube, they said he could be discharged and go home with Simon, but they wanted me to stay because they didn't think I had healed quite well enough from the surgery, and they wanted me to stay. And I wanted to go with Jack. Up until that point, I had been with her. It sounded terrible. Many births are complicated and traumatic. Sadly, Erin had copped an especially bad one. Poor thing. And many husbands do not appreciate the stress and agony involved. I can personally relate to that infuriating example of male insensitivity. At a guess, I'd say half the women on the planet can relate to that. But a modern hospital maternity ward wanting to send a baby just out of ICU home with the father, while advising the mother to stay in hospital? Would they really do that? That sounded odd. So I remember having a conversation with Simon about it, and I was really upset, and I said, I don't want to stay here by myself. I want to go home with Jack. And Simon said, you can just do it. Let's just leave. Did that involve you discharging yourself against medical advice? Asked Colin Mandy, spoon-feeding his witness. Yeah, it did. And you went back home with Jack and Simon, he repeated, just to make sure we hadn't missed it. Yep. Now I got it. The whole point of the story was to persuade us that on the Monday after the Beef Wellington lunch in 2023, when Erin discharged herself from hospital against medical advice, having just been told she could die from mushroom poisoning if they didn't admit her immediately, we, the jury, should not view that decision as anything extraordinary or out of character. Erin was used to discharging herself against medical advice. She was a veteran of such behaviour, done it a million times, and here's where it began. But did I believe it? Do you believe it? I believed the problematic birth, but the end part about discharging herself against medical advice? The defence presented nothing to corroborate this story. No records from the hospital, no signed discharge form ticking that box, no maternity nurse verifying that conversation. Nothing. Well, Simon did back it up, partly. He agreed the doctors had wanted Erin to stay in hospital longer while she recovered from her C-section, and Erin had not wanted to and had discharged herself against medical advice. But Simon made no mention of the hospital advising him to take Jack home and separating mother and child. It was still difficult to ascertain what had really happened, but maybe we could take Erin at her word, partially, sometimes. Why didn't I simply keep the by now cliched open mind and wait to see how everything added up? By April 2009, Jack was 3 months old, and he was sleeping, settled and happy. But Simon and Erin were not ones for a stable domestic routine. Simon's brother Matt and his wife Tanya were going to Broome, so Simon and Erin decided to put everything in storage, hop in their Nissan Patrol with Jack and drive up the West Australian coast to meet Matt and Tanya before heading off around the whole top end. I had to admire their spirit. After they caught up with Matt and Tanya and their kids, they all did the Gibb River Road drive together. That alone took about a week. Then Matt and Tanya went home, and Simon and Erin continued across Australia, through Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, then up the Cape York Peninsula to the very top of Queensland, then down to Townsville, camping all the way, with a baby. It was now November 2009. They'd been living out of a Nissan patrol for 7 months. Jack was 10 months old. I was exhausted just listening to it. "How were you feeling in November 2009?" Mandy inquired. "It had been a good holiday, but I'd had enough," confessed Erin. I wasn't surprised. I wanted to sleep in a real bed, and it was getting harder to camp with Jack. Like, when we started off, he slept a lot. I remember joking at the time that I couldn't remember his eye colour because his eyes were never open. So when we first started travelling, we could time our long drives with these 3-hour naps. But by November, he was sitting up and crawling and trying to stand and not sleeping as much, and it was a lot harder. All that was very easy to believe. Rang true to me. "Did you and Simon talk about that?" came the question. "Yeah, we did. The agreement we came to was that I'd fly back to Perth and Simon would follow with Jack in the patrol." Simon's version was very similar. He just said the three of them got to Townsville and Erin chose to fly herself back to Perth. On the surface, it all sounded rather cordial. Erin got on a plane and Simon packed everything up, including their young son, and drove across Australia, through the middle, back to Perth. It was a drive that took about a week. It's a 4,500-kilometre drive. But in the week that it took Simon to drive back to Perth with their son, Erin had made some changes in their accommodation arrangements. She had rented a cottage for herself and her son. When Simon pulled up, she took Jack back and left Simon to find himself a spot in a caravan park nearby. Clearly, Erin had become sick of more than just the camping. I found myself wondering what they had really said to each other before Erin flew back to Perth and walked out of the marriage. "What I understood from Erin," ventured Simon, "was that she was struggling inside herself." In other words, whatever their problems were, Simon had failed to entertain the notion that it had anything to do with him. Simon even said he organised some marriage counselling. He was the healer. That was all we were ever told about that first separation. By the end of January 2010, 2 or 3 months later, Simon had taken a job as a civil engineer in the Shire of York, about 100 kilometres east of Perth. His job package included a house, so Erin and Jack moved into that house with Simon, and the separation was over. Momentarily. Erin and Simon stayed in Western Australia from 2010 to 2013, and there were other times of separation that lasted from a few weeks to 6 months, according to Simon, but none of them were detailed for us. "There must have been some tension to cause the separations," Mandy asked Erin, speaking on behalf of the entire jury and a global media presence. "Yeah, of course," conceded Erin. "Primarily, what we struggled with over the entire course of our relationship, if we had any problems at all, it was we just couldn't communicate well when we disagreed about something. We could never communicate in a way that made each of us feel heard or understood, so we would just feel hurt and not know how to resolve it." They moved around in between separations. Erin bought a house in Quinnanup, about 3.5 hours south of Perth, with no mortgage, thanks to her grandmother's inheritance. She opened a second-hand bookstore in nearby Pemberton and ran that as a small business for a couple of years. Erin's father died in 2011, but other than confirming the date, nothing else was said about him or the event. Did she attend the funeral? Or speak at it, perhaps? Those questions weren't asked, and we don't know. We were left with no sense of any emotional connection she might have had with her father. It was just a blank. Possibly this was considered irrelevant, but it wasn't to me. In tracking the journey of her emotional relationship with Don and Gail, it would have been handy to have had some insight into the emotional relationship she shared with her own parents. But we didn't get any. So yeah, that was it. Draw your own conclusions. No one from Erin's family ever visited her in Perth. At least she never said they did, nor did Simon. But Simon's siblings visited occasionally, and various cousins, friends, and so on. Don and Gail? Mandy asked Erin. Yes, they came over twice a year, Erin replied. No big deal was made of this. It just added to the shrine. Erin got on very well with Don and Gail, and they liked her. It was a close relationship. And it was important to both Erin and Simon to cooperate with each other as the parents of Jack. Whatever the issues were in their own relationship, and obviously there were issues, both Erin and Simon agreed that they would never let those problems interfere with them being caring parents to Jack. It meant a lot to both of them. That felt and sounded genuine. It was restated throughout the whole trial. The love both Erin and Simon had for their children was never in doubt. What they genuinely felt towards each other was a much more intriguing puzzle.